Would you join me today by opening your Bibles? And we're in Matthew chapter 16. The Gospel of Matthew chapter 16. I've mentioned before that I grew up in a military family. And part of growing up in a military family is just simply that you expect you will move. It's going to happen. Get used to it. I don't feel that I lost any part of my childhood because of that. In fact, I liked being able to see different parts of the country. But ultimately, in the military, you will move, you will relocate. And at the end of the day, it's because as a military member and a military family, your will is submissive to the will of your commanding officer, your president, and your country. And so when the military says move, the answer is where, sir? Because you're going to go. It's just part of life. I will admit, though, that it does make life a little bit more challenging when it comes to planning. It's hard to plan 3 and 5 and 10 years into the future because you're not sure exactly where you're going to be. It can be hard on kids being uprooted in the middle of a school year, going to a new school with new people, a new town, new teachers, new friends, and all of that kind of thing. And so in many ways, yes, it can be more difficult, but I would say that in a lot more ways, it's freeing. And I say that because you don't have to worry. You don't have to worry about where you're going to live. You might not know where, but you know it'll be somewhere. If you're in the military, you might not know where you're going to be working, but you will have a job. You might not know who your doctor will be, but there will be one no matter where you go. You don't have to worry about whether or not there'll be schools or whether or not your basic needs will be met or whether or not you'll have a house and electricity. You might not know how it will work, but you know that it all will, that it's taken care of. And when the worry of provision is gone from a person's mind, they live a freer life. But there's a catch. It takes submission. It takes surrender. It takes coming under the will and the plan and the provision of somebody else. Now, I understand you start talking about submission and people's defenses go like way up, don't they? Because we don't like submitting. Them's fighting words in this country because we fought a war of independence so we wouldn't have to submit to other people. And as an American ideal and part of our culture, it says I can choose what I want to do with my life and no one else can tell me different. I remember being in high school and how I just could not wait to get out from under the rule of my parents' home, get out from their thumb, make my own decisions, be my own boss. And then it happened. And for about 3 months, it was kind of neat. But when I realized that with the freedom to choose also came the freedom to worry, all of the sudden life at home didn't seem so bad because I had to pay the bills and I had to go grocery shopping and I had to make my own lunch and I had to do the laundry and I had to clean the house. And so all of the sudden life at home, even though it meant giving up some control, was a lot freer than life under my own independence. Well, spiritually speaking, it's much the same thing. We as believers are called to live our life under God's will, within God's will, His plan, His authority. And I understand for a lot of believers, that's a bit of a rub because it goes against what we're taught in this world to be your own person and make up your own mind. And then here comes the church and the pastors and the Bible and Jesus saying, but submit to the will of God. And so a lot of people hesitate when it comes to something like that. But I will tell you that from personal experience, the more I surrender, the freer I am. A surrendered believer is a happy believer. And I never felt more free than the moment when I said, Lord, whatever you want with my life, I'll do. Show me where to go. Show me where to live. Show me what to do. Show me who to talk to. Whatever it is, I may not understand it, but I'm willing to go. The moment I made that commitment, it's like the weight of the world of worry was lifted off of my shoulders because now I didn't have to concern myself with the future. I just had to be obedient because I knew God had a plan. I like to think of that day as my Independence Day, because it's the day I was freed from worry. And even though it sounds odd, the only place a person can find that kind of freedom is in the spiritual act of surrender. And Jesus talks about that. He says in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5, blessed are the meek. Now, a lot of people hear the word meek and they think it means weakness, that it means inability. The truth is, it has nothing to do with that. The word meek recognizes power and control, but it says, I've surrendered that to something else. Jesus tells us that blessed, congratulations, comes from God to the person who has surrendered their life to the control of the Lord. And I will tell you, there is more freedom and more opportunity in God's will for your life than anywhere else in all of creation. Dwight L. Moody famously said one time, the sweetest lesson I have ever learned is to let the Lord choose for me. But there's a catch. We've got to be willing to follow. We've got to be willing to come under that will and to follow that direction. And in this passage this morning, that's exactly what Jesus is talking about. Coming under God's will for our life, following His plan for our life, even when it means we might not know how it will work out. And we pick up with that in Matthew 16. Notice what it says in verse 24. Then Jesus told His disciples, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done. Truly, I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. I don't know how much you know about horses, but if you know anything at all, you know a racehorse must first be broken. And it sounds like a very hostile thing, but it's actually a very special part of that horse's life, because through the process of being brought into submission of the will of the trainer, that horse is able to reach levels of potential it never would have on its own. And the same is true with us and our relationship with God. When we surrender to His will and we become subordinate to His will for our lives, we get to see Him do things through those lives we never would have seen otherwise. The Apostle Paul tells us in Philippians 4, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. And you know, that verse does not focus on I can do all things, although you might hear people say, well, I can do all things. True, but the key to that verse is through Christ. It doesn't say I can do all things if I set my mind to it. It doesn't say I can do all things if I practice really hard or I try really hard or I really, 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 really want it really bad. It says I can do all things when God works in my life. You remember Moses, don't you, from the Old Testament? Moses, just a quick history lesson, is considered to be the most righteous man in all of the Bible according to the Jewish tradition. In fact, the law they followed was regularly referred to as the law of Moses, because it was through Moses that God revealed that. It was Moses that wrote the first five books of the Bible called the Pentateuch, the five-fifths of the law. And so Moses is like a Jewish hero. But the truth is, if we were perfectly honest about Moses, we would say that on his own, the guy was kind of a bum. Because he was exiled from his own country. He was wanted for murder. His own people didn't want him. His adopted family didn't want him. He was living in a foreign land, living in the wilderness, married to somebody he had never met before that wasn't part of his people or his culture. And when we pick up with him, after all of that happens, he's leading his father-in-law's flock. On his own, Moses didn't do anything. But you know, the moment he came to that burning bush and he took off his sandals in obedience, and he dropped to his knees in praise. God worked in his life, and because of I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength, Moses was able to defy the most powerful king in the world and lead 2 million people to freedom. That's what Jesus is talking about here. You will find more freedom and more joy and more ability in surrender to God than you will anywhere else in the world. But it requires a few things. First, it requires that we take action righteously. Notice in verse 24, it says, "Then Jesus told his disciples, 'If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me.'" You know, a couple weeks ago, our preschool here had their annual dress up like what you want to be when you grow up day. And the kids came in all these costumes. And there were a lot of doctors, a lot of nurses. There was a chef. There was a vet. There were firefighters. I don't think there were lawyers or congressmen, but that's for a different day. But these kids came in dressed like what they want to be. This is their goal. This is their ambition. And it's good to have that. It's good to have something we pursue. And when God lays that on your heart, you know, Paul tells us in Colossians 3, do all things as if unto the Lord. Go after it with righteous fervor, he says. But at the same time, be willing to take the righteous action of surrendering that to his will. You know, the Apostle Paul had ambitions in ministry. He had things he wanted to do. It tells us in the book of Acts that Paul wanted to preach the gospel in a couple of different nations, specifically Asia and Bithynia. And it says in Acts 16, and they went out to the region of Phrygia and Galatia, having been forbidden to speak the word in Asia. And when they came to Mysia, they attempted to go into Bithynia, but the Spirit of Jesus did not allow them. And so here Paul has a goal. He says, I want to preach in Asia. I want to minister to those people. I want to go to Bithynia. I want to minister to those people. Those are my goals. That's my aspiration. And yet God said, no, I want you to go somewhere else. And it goes on to say in the very next verse, and a vision appeared to Paul in the night. And a man of Macedonia was standing there, urging him and saying, come over to Macedonia and help us. And when Paul had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go into Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach to them. And so Paul had a plan, but he surrendered and submitted that plan to the will of God, even when it meant going in a different direction. I like what James tells us in chapter 4 of his letter. Come now, you who say today or tomorrow we'll go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. But he goes on to say, yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. Instead, you ought to say, if God wills. You see, the problem isn't the plan. The problem is not submitting the plan to the will of God. And that's what this verse is all about. It's about dropping what we're doing or being willing to and following God's will for our life. Now, there's a pretty common misconception when it comes to this verse, that it talks about personal sin and personal struggle, and you'll hear people say that the cross you bear is the sin that you struggle with. But the truth is, it doesn't discuss that here, and we know that because Jesus uses his own experience as the example. Pick up your cross refers to what Jesus was about to do. Well, Jesus didn't struggle with sin. He was tempted, but the Bible said, yet without sin. And so this can't be talking about dealing with personal sin. What it is talking about is setting aside personal ambition, picking up God's will for your life, whatever that may be. And we see Jesus say the same thing in his prayer in Matthew 26. You remember last week we talked about it, where Jesus is praying at the Garden of Gethsemane, the very night he's about to be arrested. And he says, Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. In other words, if there is any way to possibly save humanity and restore them to relationship with you, let's do that because this cross doesn't look fun. But he follows it up by saying, nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And so this cross isn't personal struggle. This cross represents personal surrender. This is coming under the will of God for our life, even though we may not understand where it's taking us. And you remember, that's how Jesus even taught us to pray. His disciples said, Lord, teach us how to pray. And he said in Matthew chapter 6, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We're even taught to pray seeking God's will for our life. And let me say, there's more freedom in that kind of surrender to God's will than in all the worldly independence you will ever find. Imagine a captain of a sailboat for a minute. He has his boat. He wants to take it out to the ocean. And the directions of the boat say one thing, but he takes it farther from the shore than they recommend. And he doesn't open the sail. And he steers it against the wind. He can do that. That's his boat. He's the captain of his boat. But I guarantee you it won't work. He'll just be battered by those waves, tossed back and forth, and eventually that captain will say something like, My boat's broken. It doesn't work. This isn't what I signed up for. This isn't what I'm trying to do. But on the other hand, if that captain stays close to shore like recommended, if he opens those sails to receive the wind and turns into that wind the way that boat is designed, did he give up some control? Sure he did. Did he give up say-so? Sure he did. But what he gained was more freedom and more joy than he would have ever had otherwise. And the same is true in our faith. You will get more out of life when you make the decision to follow God's will than trying to do it on your own. In the book of James, he tells us every good gift and every perfect gift comes down from the Father of lights. Well, imagine all of those good gifts and all of those perfect gifts put into the parameters of God's will for your life. When you choose to follow that plan, you get into that. But when you go about it your own way, when we don't open our sails, when we go against the wind, when we say, well, that's what God wants me to do, but, you know, this is my life and my boat and I'm going to take it where I want. What ends up happening is we get knocked around by life and people say, what's going wrong? Why am I here? Why do all these bad things seem to happen to me? Now, don't misunderstand me. Following God's will does not mean you will not have challenges, but you will be able to navigate them. He will give you the strength to make it through. As David said in Psalm 23, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, he didn't deny the challenges. He said, I fear no evil, for you are with me. When we give up control to God, sure, we give up some say-so, but we give more joy and we get more peace and a deeper relationship with the Lord than we ever would have on our own. And so the first part of surrendering to God's will and following His plan for your life means taking action righteously. Second, it means acknowledging that God works counterculturally. And notice in verse 25, Jesus says, For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. It's a bit of an odd thing to hear. The best way to find something is to lose it first. It sounds like a contradiction, but you should know, in theology, there is a doctrine called biblical inerrancy. It is a foundational doctrine of our Christian faith, and it tells us that the Bible is absolutely 100% inerrant. There are no contradictions found in Scripture. There is never a time where it tells you to do one thing here and the opposite thing there. It does not lead to confusion. It does not lead to contradiction. In John chapter 1, it says, In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then later down, I think if you go to verse 14 or so, it says, And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. You see, we believe that the Bible and Jesus Christ are related. And the way I explain that to people is if you take the intangible will and word and perfect nature of God and put it into a person, you get Jesus Christ. If you take that same nature and put it into writing, you get the Bible. And because the Bible represents God's perfect will, and because we understand God and Jesus are one, and because Jesus and His Word are one, we understand that the Bible never contradicts itself at all. And that's not just some claim from a pulpit. You should know that skeptics will even acknowledge that. They don't believe what the Bible teaches, but they will at least say it's consistent because it has been studied and compared, and it has never been found to contradict itself. But it does contradict the world. It does go against cultural wisdom and what this world would tell you is a normal way of life. This past Friday, that nor'easter storm came through here and knocked out power for thousands of people. And I was actually sitting in my office around midday watching out the window as the wind just kind of whipped the snow across the parking lot and the field and back. And I remember thinking to myself, boy, I wonder about those people who are out driving in this and how many accidents there's going to be. Because there was a lot of slush. Those roads weren't good. Even when I went home at about 3:30, those roads were terrible. If you ever are on the road driving and you lose control of your car, you know what they say to do? Turn into the direction you're going. Blew my mind. They say it's the instinct of people to turn against the direction, but actually the proper thing to do is not hit the brakes, turn into the way you're drifting because you get all four tires rolling and you can regain control of that car a lot sooner. But that violates our conventional wisdom. We don't head into danger, we head away from it. The Bible goes against conventional wisdom. Jesus said in Matthew 5, blessed are the persecuted. Now, where else in the world will you hear someone say there is blessing, there is a congratulations to be given to the person who is suffering? We don't think that way. The world doesn't support that kind of idea. And yet God says you are blessed when you suffer for your faith. Or when Jesus said in John 17, right before he went to the cross, Father, glorify me was his prayer. Now, that doesn't make any earthly sense because the cross was not designed to bring glory, but rather it was designed to humiliate. It was an implement of torture that was adopted by the Roman Empire to bring into a state of humiliation the person who was hanging from it. And in fact, it was so terrible and so degrading and so painful that Rome had laws forbidding its citizens from being subjected to the cross. And yet before Jesus goes to that cross, he says, glorify me. And we know when he was lifted onto that cross, he entered into the glory of God right there on that mountain. Well, here in chapter 16, verse 25, Jesus says, whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake, well, he will find it. And that sounds like it goes against conventional wisdom. Because the last time I checked, the best way to find something isn't to lose it first. And yet Jesus says that's exactly what we do with life. And if we think about it, it makes perfect sense. Because seeking after stuff of this life doesn't last. And that's not just a spiritual saying. Scientifically, it's true. There is something called the law of entropy, and it tells us that in nature, everything is constantly moving from a state of order to a state of chaos. That's why things break down over time. That's why if you have something shiny and you put it in your closet and pull it out a month later, it's dull. It's an unstoppable law of nature. And so when a person seeks after this world, if that's what they're trying to find, they're chasing something that ultimately will not last. And spiritually, they can't take. When they used to bury Egyptian kings in their tombs, they would surround them with gold and jewels and all kinds of wealth. Everything they amassed in this life. And the idea was, when they entered into the afterlife, they'd take all that with them. And you know how they know that? Because when they open those tombs, the gold is still there. It didn't go anywhere. It's corroded, it's degraded, and it's all still there. That's the point Jesus is making. When we chase the stuff of this world, it might be temporarily satisfying, but it is eternally disappointing because it won't last and we can't take it. On the other hand, when a person surrenders their life to Jesus and they take on the perspective of thy will be done, whatever it is you have in mind for my life, Lord, that's what I want. When a person goes into that mentality, they find something that never corrodes and is never lost. 1 Peter 1 tells us a living hope through Jesus Christ. to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you. You see, this world is not your final destination. This is not our final home. We're just passing through. We're visiting. Enjoy the sights. Enjoy the sounds. Enjoy the smells. Go after ambition and goals and dreams. But keep in mind, this is just a glimpse of things to come. And so even though it goes against conventional wisdom, the best way to get the most is to first lose. So we surrender to God's plan that takes action made righteously. We give up our own ambition. We give up our own goals and our plan and our will. And we say, Lord, whatever you have for my life, that's what I want to do. So it's action righteously. It's acknowledging God works counterculturally, because often it will go against what the world would suggest. And finally, as we close, it takes a bit of accounting spiritually. Notice in verse 26, it says, for what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Several years back, I had a dad come to me, and he was looking for some pastoral advice. He was in a bit of a quandary because he was a devout believer. His whole family were Christian. He had a middle school daughter who really enjoyed playing sports. The problem was, all of their games were on Sunday morning. And so he, like so many other parents, was struggling with the decision, what do I do? Do I have her be in church and risk that she resents that? Or do I let her go to the game and then she doesn't get her relationship with God built the way it's designed to be? And so he just didn't know what to do. And to make it worse, she was really good. And I mean like full ride scholarship to college kind of good. And so he came to me and he said, we want to invest in her future. We want her to go to school. We want this for her because she's very good. But at the same time, we want her to be in church. And I don't know how to decide. And I asked him a question. I said, well, let me ask this. 10 years from now, she got that full ride scholarship. She's at college. She's living on campus. She's doing fairly well for herself. And one night, she finds herself alone in a dorm room with a boy. What do you want her to remember? The stuff she learned on that court or the stuff she learned in that seat? And I will say they never missed another Sunday. That dad called the coach the next day and said, we'll be there Sunday afternoon, but Sunday morning is given to God. You see, sometimes the cost is too high. Sometimes it's not a good trade. It isn't worth it. Jesus says here in verse 26, what would it profit if a man gained the whole world but forfeits his soul? It wouldn't be worth it. It's a simple matter of spiritual accounting. What's worth more? What can you take with you? What benefits you more? It's a cost analysis. What will it cost me and what do I get out of it? What will be more valuable? The stuff of the world that corrodes and decays and we can't take with us after about 80 years anyway? Or the stuff of heaven that doesn't decay and doesn't perish and you get to keep for all of eternity? Stuff that once you receive it, Jesus said, no one can separate you from. You see, God has a plan for your life, and that plan includes more blessing and more righteousness and a closer relationship than any person could possibly realize. But it takes surrender. It takes submission. It takes coming under the will of God and the plan of God for our life. It takes telling the Lord, whatever it is you would have for me, I'm going to go. I'm going to point my boat into the direction of your will. I'm going to open my sails and receive everything you have to give me. And when a person adopts that kind of mentality and that approach to their relationship with God, they will receive more freedom, more blessing, more joy, more peace than they would ever have on their own.